The Meaning of Marxism by Paul D'Amato. Section: How the Revolution Was Won. The Bolsheviks were an activist party with a mass base among Russia's 3 million industrial workers. On the eve of the October Revolution in 1917, its membership stood at 240,000. The party was neither perfect nor the monolith that Stalinist hacks later made it out to be. But there can be no doubt that it was a mass party, not a clique of revolutionaries, when it led the Russian Revolution to victory. Manchester Guardian correspondent Morgan Phillips Price, by no means a supporter of the Bolsheviks, whom he called maximalists, offered this observation on the eve of the revolution. Quote, "The maximalist fanatics, who still dream of the social revolution throughout all Europe, have, according to my observations in the provinces, recently acquired an immense, if not amorphous, following." He notes with a tone of disdain, quote, "The majority of their followers, however, have no idea what the maximalist means when he talks of all power to the councils. The peasant, furious with the delay in the land reform, hears promises of immediate seizure of the landlord's land and goes with him. The worker hears talks about state control over the banks and goes with him. All the recent provincial elections have given immense majorities to this wing of the revolutionary democracy." End quote. The revolution came in two installments. On February the 23rd, 1917, International Women's Day, hundreds of thousands of Russian workers took to the streets of Russia's capital, Petrograd, inaugurating a series of mass protests and strikes that would, in a matter of days, bring down a monarchy that had ruled Russia for centuries. 8 months later, in a second installment, armed workers, led by the Bolshevik Party, brought down the capitalist provincial government that had rushed in to reestablish order after the Tsar's fall. In its place ruled the Soviets, the democratic councils of workers, soldiers, sailors, and poor peasants that had been hastily erected throughout Russia after the February Revolution. The revolution combined two revolts, that of the peasants in the countryside and of workers in the towns. This was because Russian economic development had combined the old with the new. In his History of the Russian Revolution, Trotsky quoted Marx's statement that the country that is more developed industrially only shows, to the less developed, the image of its own future. This idea, however, has become less applicable in proportion as capitalist evolution has embraced all countries, wrote Trotsky. Quote, "England in her day revealed the future of France, considerably less of Germany, but not in the least of Russia and not of India." End quote. Newcomers to capitalism after Britain did not simply repeat the same gradual stages English economic development went through, but combined and even skipped some. In Russia, more backwards forms of economic life combined with the most modern forms, which were simply grafted on top of the old. Capitalism did not develop in late 19th century Russia gradually out of its own village handicrafts. On the contrary, with the aid of state intervention and an influx of foreign capital, modern factories were built alongside villages of wood and straw. Peasants were thrown into the factory cauldron, snatched directly from the plow, wrote Trotsky. Russia in 1917 was a country made up overwhelmingly of peasants, scratching out a meager existence under the sway of big landowners. But it was also a country where state intervention and foreign investment had superimposed the world's most modern factories on top of Russia's old feudal structure. This peculiarity of development gave rise to a weak capitalist class, dependent on the state and foreign capital, fearful of its own shadow. One sign of its weakness was the fact that the party most identified with the liberal bourgeoisie, the Constitutional Democrats, or cadets, wasn't formed until 1905. On the other hand, Russia's industrial working class, though numerically a minority, were tremendously concentrated in a few urban centers, like Petrograd and Moscow, giving them a relative power that far exceeded their numbers. The two wings of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party, RSDLP, Menshevik and Bolshevik, had very different views of Russia's revolution, which affected their approach to it. The two groups had split apart in 1903 over what initially seemed a small difference, conditions for membership in the party. The Bolsheviks wanted a stricter definition of a member that would ensure that only active participants were members, whereas the Mensheviks favored a looser, much broader concept. But bigger differences developed from there, and after the first Russian Revolution in 1905, it was clear that the two factions had very different conceptions of what a revolution in Russia should look like. Initially, both the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks believed that Russian economic backwardness meant that the country would repeat the path taken by Western Europe, as described in Marx's statement above. There would be two distinct revolutions, one bourgeois, which would overthrow czarism, establish Western-style democracy, and distribute land to the peasants, and later a second, working-class revolution, which would bring about socialism. Lenin, for example, argued again and again that Russia was too economically backward to move directly to socialism. But here, the similarities ended sharply. The Mensheviks believed that the liberal Russian bourgeoisie would have to lead the revolution, in the same way that the French bourgeoisie had led the revolution in 1789. The role of the socialists, in their view, was to mobilize the working class to put pressure on the bourgeoisie to fulfill this task. Consequently, they always cautioned the working class not to do anything that might frighten the capitalist class into the arms of reaction. The Bolsheviks, however, argued that the Russian capitalists were far too tied up with the landowning classes to lead a revolt against the autocracy. The bourgeoisie as a whole is incapable of waging a determined struggle against the autocracy, Lenin argued. Quote, "It fears to lose in this struggle its property, which binds it to the existing order. It fears an all too revolutionary action of the workers, who will not stop at the democratic revolution, but will aspire to the socialist revolution. It fears a complete break with officialdom, with the bureaucracy, whose interests are bound up by a thousand ties with the interests of the propertied classes. For this reason, the bourgeois struggle for liberty is notoriously timorous, inconsistent, and half-hearted." End quote. This view was amply confirmed during the revolution. After the Tsar abdicated, Rodzianko, the liberal president of Russia's toothless parliament, or Duma, covered his face and cried, "My God, how horrible! Without government, anarchy, blood." The practical difference between positions was that while the Mensheviks sought to hold back workers' militancy so as not to provoke the liberals into bolting from the role Menshevism has allotted them, the Bolsheviks criticized the liberals and sought to organize the working class independently of them. Only the working class, they argued, could head the movement, uniting behind them the oppressed peasants. Incidentally, the Menshevik line became the basis, later, for the Stalinist conception that revolutions must of necessity go through two stages, the democratic and then the socialist one. Trotsky took the Bolsheviks' line of reasoning a step further. If the town leads the country, and the capitalists cannot lead their revolution, then workers must lead it, in alliance with the peasantry. In this, his views coincided with Lenin's. But if the workers led, then they would not be able to stop at the democratic or bourgeois stage. After a successful revolution, workers would be compelled to retain power in their own hands and begin to push through socialist measures. Trotsky did not disagree with the moderate socialists who argued that Russia was not economically ripe for socialism. But Trotsky placed his fate in its international contexts. Workers could begin the fight for socialism, but could not complete it without the revolution spreading and taking hold in other, more economically advanced countries. Trotsky viewed the revolution as a link in an international chain of struggle, not as an isolated national event. Trotsky called this theory, which he first formulated in 1905, permanent revolution. By permanent, Trotsky did not mean endless, but rather a revolution that would not stop halfway, and would proceed until all exploiting classes had been driven from power. The First World War brought disaster to Russia. Food shortages, disease, and the slaughter of troops at the front. All these factors came to a head in 1917. On the top, the ruling circles became utterly paralyzed. The Tsar and Tsarina retreating into mysticism. Their ministers unable to act. Corruption and graft rampant. The fanatic cruelty of the ruling couple was best expressed in a letter to the Tsar by the Tsarina, in which she exclaimed, "Russia loves to feel the whip. That is their nature." Trotsky described how the Tsar praised as fine fellows a certain regiment for shooting down workers, and how he read with satisfaction how they flogged with whips the bob-haired girl students, or cracked the heads of defenseless people during Jewish pogroms. As the war wore on, soldiers deserted in droves. After a short patriotic lull, workers began to go back out into the streets, renewing the fervor they had exhibited through mass strikes before the war broke out in 1914. Hundreds of thousands of workers struck and demonstrated, confronting the Tsar's police and troops. Discipline in the armed forces cracked, and whole regiments joined the revolution, turning against the police, who stayed loyal to the Tsar. The Tsar completely lost his grip on power in a matter of days. The movement was not led by any political party. It began as a spontaneous revolt against food shortages. But many of its leaders on the ground were Bolshevik militants. The outcome of the Tsar's overthrow was dual power. On the one side, workers and soldiers created the Soviet of Workers and Soldiers Deputies, based on one delegate for every 1,000 workers or soldiers. On the other side, the liberal landowners and bourgeois representatives formed, after some prodding and begging from the Menshevik leaders, the Provisional Government. This was, in fact, a counter-revolutionary government. It fully recommitted Russia to the imperialist war. It opposed workers' control in the factories, and opposed land seizures by the peasants, all the while promising at some future date, always put off, a constituent assembly that would solve Russia's problems. The Soviet had at this point far more power and prestige than the provisional government. However, the delegates of the first Soviet meeting elected Mensheviks and socialist revolutionary leaders who were committed to handing power to others. Though the peasantry formed its mass base, the SR party balked at immediate land redistribution, appealing to the peasantry to wait for elections to a promised constituent assembly rather than take action into its own hands. Those socialists who stood at the head of the Soviet, wrote Trotsky, were already looking around with alarm to see if they could find a real boss. They took it for granted that the power ought to pass to the bourgeoisie. End quote. Consequently, they insisted that the provisional government take power into its hands, even though the liberals who comprised it feared the and expected the Soviet to arrest them. As the situation unfolded, the moderate Mensheviks and the SRs not only supported the provisional government, but entered it as cabinet members. The Bolsheviks had 5,000 members at the start of the revolution, were concentrated in the biggest factories of Petrograd and other towns, and had a mass circulation, Pravda, or Truth in Russian, that regularly sold 40,000 copies. They were thus in no position immediately to lead a revolt against the provisional government. In these initial stages of the revolution, they were still scattered and disorganized by months of intense police repression. They began with only a small minority of delegates in the Petrograd Soviet, 40 out of 1,600. What accounted for this paradox? The elections to the organs and institutions of the victorious revolution attract and challenge the infinitely broader masses than those who battled with arms in hands, wrote Trotsky. In this early phase, workers did not make a distinction between the different socialist parties, and the influence of the intellectuals and of the petty officers in the army impressed their moderating stamp on consciousness. Quote, in giving their confidence to the socialists, the workers and the soldiers found themselves, quite unexpectedly, expropriated politically. A period of struggle was necessary to clarify where matters stood, who was for workers' power and who was not. The country, argued Lenin from exile, is passing from the first stage of the revolution, which, owing to the insufficient class consciousness and organization of the proletariat, is in the hands of the bourgeoisie, to its second stage, which must place power into the hands of the proletariat and the poorest sections of the peasants. End quote. At first, Lenin's views were not embraced by other party leaders. Clinging to the old formula that Russia must first pass through a bourgeois phase, many, Stalin for example, called for critical support for the provisional government. But the essence of party policy had in fact been to stress the leading role of the working class in the revolution. Entire party committees, including the famous industrial Vyborg district of Petrograd, had already come to the conclusion that the provisional government should be replaced by Soviet power. After some hard debate, in which they were able to appeal to the rank and file of the party, that had in many cases come independently to the same conclusions, Lenin and others were able to convince the party leaders of a strategy aimed at transferring all power to the Soviets. Thus, in practice, Lenin adopted Trotsky's theory of permanent revolution. It should be noted here that, even in the heat of the mass movement, the Bolsheviks made major decisions on the basis of open and democratic debate and discussion. There were countless times when Lenin was in fact a minority in the leadership and had to fight to convince the others of his views, The myth of the Bolshevik Party as a conspiratorial dictatorship derives from a misreading of the party's history. During periods of autocratic reaction, all left-wing parties in Russia were forced to operate clandestinely, and, consequently, no democracy was possible because no open meetings were possible. But whenever the class struggle created the conditions for the party to operate more openly, the party followed the principle of democratic decision-making and debate. Lenin argued that workers' power must replace the provisional government. Quote, "The Soviet of Workers' Deputies is an organization of the workers, the embryo of a works government, the representative of the interests of the entire mass of the poor sections of the population, i.e. of 9/10 of the population, which is striving for peace, bread, and freedom." He who says that the workers must support the new provisional government in the interests of the struggle against Tsarist reaction is a traitor to the workers. For the only guarantee of freedom and of complete destruction of Tsarism lies in the arming of the proletariat, in strengthening, extending, and developing the role, significance, and power of the Soviet of Workers' Deputies. End quote. The Bolsheviks were not interested in a putsch by a minority, let alone a rising by the working class without support among the soldiers and peasantry. The task of the Bolsheviks, Lenin wrote, was to, quote, "patiently explain to the as yet unconvinced the need for the movement to transfer all power to the Soviets, that only a Soviet government would end the war, give land to the peasants, and create a full democracy in Russia. Once they secured a majority for this position in the Soviets, which served as a barometer for mass feeling, the provisional government could be replaced by Soviet power." The Bolshevik line struck a chord with a growing number of workers, and thousands of them joined the party. Already, by April, workers in Petrograd were demonstrating in support of Bolshevik demands. Here, the Bolsheviks played a crucial role in the struggle, actually restraining a premature insurrection. By June, a majority of workers in Petrograd supported the Bolsheviks and were ready to overthrow the provisional government. The danger, as the Bolshevik leaders saw it, was that a revolt in Petrograd would be isolated and easily crushed. More time was needed to win over Moscow and other towns. In early July, Lenin and the other leaders appeared at the head of an armed demonstration and, much to the chagrin of protesters, urged calm. After a series of desultory armed clashes with police, the protests disintegrated, and for a few weeks the Bolsheviks were driven underground. Lenin, framed on trumped-up charges that he was a German agent, and vilified by the other socialist parties, was forced to flee to Finland to avoid arrest and possible execution. Trotsky and some other Bolshevik leaders were arrested. But the movement was not crushed, and the Bolsheviks quickly bounced back. Trotsky was released, and in a new upsurge of revolutionary ferment, as the elected leader of the Petrograd Soviet, as he was and had been in 1905 when he was only 25 years old. He was also elected head of the Military Revolutionary Committee, which was set up to mobilize workers' militias and troops loyal to the Soviet to defend it against counter-revolutionary forces. Then, in August, a right-wing general, Lavr Kornilov, began mobilizing a coup to smash both the Soviets and the provisional government, which was headed by the right-wing socialist revolutionary leader Alexander Kerensky. The ruling class had decided, in a last-ditch effort, that Kerensky could not be depended upon to repress the revolution, and so he had to go. The Bolsheviks, the only party left untainted by support for or participation in the provisional government, proposed a joint struggle to all the Soviet parties, even those that had supported crushing the Bolsheviks during the July days, aimed at stopping Kornilov. They proposed to Kerensky a united front against the coup, though not relinquishing their criticisms of the provisional government. Lenin argued that the provisional government could be dealt with more easily once the immediate threat of a coup was defeated. With Bolshevik militants in the lead, Kornilov's conspiracy was dissolved before it ever reached Petrograd. Workers simply stopped Kornilov's troop trains and convinced his soldiers to switch sides. The Bolsheviks acquitted themselves as the best and most consistent defenders of the revolution. And, as a result, after August 1917, they won a majority of delegates in the Soviets. Lenin, Trotsky, and a handful of other leaders argued that the time for talk had passed, and that workers now expected the Bolsheviks to organize an insurrection to disperse the provisional government and transfer all power to the Soviets. Lenin came up against resistance from some of the Bolshevik leaders, like Kamenev and Zinoviev, who feared that the time wasn't ripe. But Lenin, Trotsky, and others were able to overcome this hesitancy and win the Bolshevik leadership to insurrection. So the party, in the end, played three crucial roles. First, it outlined a clear strategic policy aimed at winning a majority of workers to the idea that they should take power into their own hands. Second, it was able to tactically restrain sections of the class when it was clear that other sections were not ready to go. Third, it was able to win a majority of workers to its side by demonstrating in practice its superior leadership in the struggle, informed by a clear set of politics that corresponded to workers' own experience as the revolution unfolded. The result was that on October 25th, the Bolshevik Party and its allies organized a successful armed insurrection. The time was meant to coincide with the opening of the Congress of Soviets, and Trotsky, who had recently been elected president of the Petrograd Soviet, provided capable leadership of the uprising. Workers easily dispersed the provisional government and transferred power to the Soviets. Though the subsequent civil war and isolation of the revolution eventually robbed Russian workers of their victory, the Russian Revolution shows us not only that ordinary people can change society, but that to win, we must build a network of organized, conscious revolutionaries committed to that change. "Not by compromise with the propertied classes," wrote the revolution's able chronicler John Reed, an American journalist, quote, "or with the other political leaders. Not by conciliating the old government mechanism did the Bolsheviki conquer power, nor by the organized violence of a small clique. If the masses all over Russia had not been ready for insurrection, it must have failed. The only reason for Bolshevik success lay in their accomplishing the vast and simple desires of the most profound strata of people, calling them to the work of tearing down and destroying the old, and afterward, in the smoke of falling ruins, cooperating with them to erect the framework of the new." End section.